The Crimopedia podcast is a completely independent show that explores content of a potentially violent and disturbing nature. Please use your listening discretion. Extra trigger warning for this episode. We will be discussing missing and murdered Indigenous women and some history around the injustices faced by Indigenous peoples in Canada, both past and present. Hi everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Crimopedia podcast, and the last in the MMIWG 2S Plus series. Buckle up, because today we're talking about one of Canada's most bizarre and elusive serial killers, who targeted Indigenous women, largely in Vancouver, British Columbia, unsurprisingly all while evading serious criminal consequences. The killings of Gilbert Jordan, also known as the Boozing Barber, occurred just before the time of Robert Picton, who we've all talked about before, but the atrocities of Robert Picton feel even more exacerbated by the fact that Gilbert Jordan was preying on the exact same victim pool from the exact same area, Vancouver's downtown east side. Although his total deceased victim count is less than Robert Picton's, Gilbert Jordan's strange modus operandi, hypothesized underlying sexual desires, and complete disregard for human life make his insidious nature equally dangerous and terrifying, especially when paired with how little attention police were paying to the deaths of Indigenous women in the area, as we know. With that, let's jump right in to the final episode in this series. Gilbert Paul Jordan was born on December 12th of 1931, born as Gilbert Paul Elsie. Finding information about his upbringing was a little difficult, as is expected when we're talking about almost 100 years ago in the past, but what I could find were reports that he lived in a relatively calm household, at least on paper, and he had two brothers, neither of which got into trouble in their adult lives. These details become important when we begin to discuss the depravity of Gilbert. It often seems to be the case that many violent offenders we discuss on this show suffer from some sort of childhood trauma, often related to familial abuse or addiction, but neither were the case for Gilbert Jordan. And although it's also worth mentioning that not every person subject to childhood abuse or the likes of parents with substance use disorders will go on to become violent serial killers, it's also worth mentioning that nobody else in Gilbert's family is reported to have expressed the same unsatiable urges for dominance, control, and willingness to undertake whatever violent acts necessary to maintain those things. The only details of relevance I could find about his childhood that may help us answer why he turned out the way he did was that he was bullied a little bit. He was reportedly picked on at school for his stature. Gilbert Jordan was short and stocky, and as a result, I assume he struggled to reconcile his desires for intimacy with the complete lack of interest flocking his way, given his appearance. Although there was nothing objectively wrong with the way he looked, he was just short, a little stocky, and he had thick-rimmed glasses even into adulthood, kids can be cruel, and I speculate that enduring all of grade school being called chubs and feeling rejected from his peers did make a lasting impression on him. But again, that's all I could find about his childhood. There aren't many other details that may help better explain why he turned out the way he did. However, the manifestations of his deeply sick mind began as soon as he became an adult, at the ripe age of 18. At least, that's where the paper trail starts. Although I can imagine there was a lifetime of self-ascribed victimhood brewing in Gilbert throughout his bullying and whatever else he may or may not have endured. He ended up dropping out of high school as soon as he could, at 16, and his criminal record begins very soon after his 18th birthday, when he was arrested for car theft in 1950, receiving a 12-month sentence. In my view, I think it's fair to argue sometimes that young people make stupid mistakes and often can learn from them and rehabilitate and become better. However, this wasn't the case for Gilbert Jordan. After receiving the 12-month sentence for car theft when he was 18, it simply seemed to excite him that he could get himself into so much danger. Either that, or he simply couldn't fight the urge to stay away from it. Throughout the 50s, Gilbert Jordan got himself involved in petty crimes here and there, including breaking and entering, more car thefts, public intoxication. But then we jump to 1961, when his depravity escalated, resulting in Gilbert Jordan abducting a 5-year-old indigenous little girl who was found in his car, which was parked in a nearby gravel pit. The little girl was found alive, but she was very far away from the reservation lands which she lived, and who knows what his plans were for her. Due to the age of this case, you'll have to bear with me, but it's unclear how the investigation into this crime even played out. I can't find much information about how police were able to locate this girl, or how they knew that she was in his possession, or how they undertook their due diligence to follow up on an investigation. However, I do know two things. I know firstly that charges for abduction were stayed for unknown reasons, leading to no conviction against Gilbert Jordan for the kidnapping of this 5-year-old girl. I know secondly that as a result, despite this being a horrific crime that was likely only less so because he was caught before he could seriously harm this child, this crime was never accounted for anywhere in subsequent proceedings involving Gilbert, almost like it didn't contribute to a story of depravity that would only continue to escalate as he got older, therefore beginning a pattern of him slipping out of the grasp of law enforcement on account of them having really no idea what his history was. The only time Gilbert Jordan was ever meaningfully reprimanded by police happened to be later that same year in 1961, and then basically never again. Just after Christmas of 61, Gilbert Jordan parked his vehicle nearby the Lions Gate Bridge in Vancouver. He then exited his vehicle, climbed up onto the structure, and halted traffic while making a scene, threatening to jump and end his own life. If you're unfamiliar with the geography of the area, it's worth noting that Lions Gate Bridge is only one of two ways to enter Vancouver from the north, as it is largely surrounded by water. However, back then, the Lions Gate Bridge was the only way, as the Iron Workers Memorial Bridge, also known as the Second Narrows Bridge, which stands currently, was not even built yet. So, of course, Gilbert's actions in blocking the only route into Vancouver caused a big ordeal, and after being talked down from the ledge either by police or his own criminal attorney, as reports differ, he was arrested. As I briefly mentioned, he had been previously let off on most charges, so during his trial for public intoxication related to the Lions Gate Bridge, as it was found that he was drunk, it should have followed suit that he might be let off again. However, for unknown reasons, Gilbert Jordan stood up and directed a Nazi salute at the presiding judge, prompting an additional charge of contempt and a 6-month sentence. Although Vancouver police were likely relieved in some capacity that this guy with a tendency for petty crimes was finally off the streets, at least for a short while, let me be very explicit in pointing out that he got in more trouble for contempt of court than he did for the abduction of a 5-year-old girl. On my website at crimopediapod.ca, I've posted a link to an old newspaper clipping from the Vancouver Sun, which details most of Gilbert Jordan's crimes in chronological order. I encourage you to check it out alongside all other sources I use for the episode today. But let's continue through some of the highlights of his crimes, which demonstrate the way that he escalated, leading up to the tragic death of at least 7 women. In 1962, less than a year after the Lions Gate Bridge incident and the child abduction, Gilbert Jordan got 2 women drunk at a bar on Vancouver Island and lured them back to his parked car, enticing them with more alcohol and promises to keep the good vibes going. He drove the 2 women to a place called Coal Harbor, which is a remote location far north of the island. The 3 continued to drink in his car, and when one of the women stepped out of his vehicle to be sick from drinking all that liquor, he put his keys in the ignition and sped away, leaving her in the desolate industrial area of Coal Harbor all by herself, and making off with her purse and her friend. Although I couldn't find too much information about what exactly happened next, it was alleged that he drove even farther north of the island and sexually assaulted the other woman in his car. And again, although unclear how the investigation played out, evidently, Gilbert was arrested and charged for rape and 2 counts of theft over $50 on account of the purse being left behind by the woman who stepped out of the vehicle to be sick. However, as was the typical outcome for Gilbert Jordan in courts of law, he was acquitted of the sexual assault charge. According to the Dark Poutine podcast episode about this case, which is number 15, This was likely due to a combination of intoxication of all parties, ethnicity of the victims, and perceived reliability of the victim. Remember, the women that Gilbert Jordan went after were young, mostly indigenous, and doomed to live difficult lives in Vancouver's downtown east side, vulnerable to predators like Gilbert Jordan, and historically and presently ignored by police. Although he was acquitted for the sexual assault, he was convicted of the theft charges, and he received 2 years for each charge, which were to be served concurrently. However, according to the same article I mentioned by the Vancouver Sun, these charges were later dismissed on appeal. The ironic thing about Gilbert Jordan getting away with sexual assault on account of the victim's intoxication, which is an underlying theme of this whole case, is that it's rooted in racist stigmatization involving Indigenous peoples and alcohol, as well as Indigenous women and their inherent value, but Gilbert Jordan himself was a raging alcoholic. It's reported that, at the height of his addiction and activity as a serial murderer, he was consuming up to 50 ounces or a liter and a half of straight vodka every single day. The irony underlying the juxtaposition of letting him escape justice, likely in part due to biases against Indigenous women and their perceived lack of self-governance ability when it comes to alcohol. Meanwhile, he himself is the uncontrollable alcoholic wreaking havoc on vulnerable communities, is not lost on me. And even further, the abhorrent blatancy of this sick irony becomes even more pronounced when we jump to 1965, when Gilbert Jordan killed his first victim, at least his first on record, and when he developed his modus operandi, using alcohol to build rapport with largely Indigenous women in Vancouver's downtown east side, before using even more alcohol to murder them. In January of 1965, Switchboard operator Ivy Rose Oswald was found naked and deceased in a Vancouver hotel room. One report I read stated that Ivy was Gilbert's girlfriend at the time, but all the other reports I read stated otherwise, and that she was simply an unsuspecting victim. Ivy was found with a blood alcohol level, or BAC, of 0.51. For context, in the province of British Columbia, the legal limit to drive while drinking is 0.05. At 0.15, you're at risk of nausea, vomiting, falling over, and having a serious hangover in the morning. Between 0.3 and 0.4, you're at a serious risk of alcohol poisoning. And at and above 0.4, you're at risk of death. And yet she was at 0.51. Gilbert Jordan, by however means, as again the records are sparse, was questioned about Ivy Rose's death and his involvement, and he did admit to being in her company on the night of her death. He also was found to have some of her belongings on him when he was questioned. But ultimately, her death was ruled accidental, and no charges were laid. Coincidentally, or likely not so, almost immediately following Ivy's death, Gilbert petitioned to legally change his name from Gilbert Elsie to Gilbert Jordan, likely to give him a clean slate in society, now that he was being at least loosely tied to his ever-increasingly escalating crimes. Clearly, he had no intention of stopping. Between 1969 and 1975, Gilbert Jordan was charged and convicted of several crimes. Some of the highlights include two drunk driving charges on the same day in 1969, which I don't know how that happened, but it happened. A charge of lewd public acts in 1971, to which a conviction never stuck. A 1973 charge of indecent exposure, which reports differ on if a conviction stuck. A 1974 charge and conviction for indecent assault, where he was sentenced to 2 years less a day, but only served 1 year, and was able to dodge a petition from the Crown, which is effectively the criminal prosecutor, to have him designated as a dangerous sexual offender. When he was released in 1975, he almost immediately abducted and sexually assaulted a woman from a psychiatric institution, and was charged with kidnapping and sexual intercourse with feeble-minded. In between his spree of sex crimes, he was briefly married to a woman in 1972, but due to his chronic drunkenness and tendency towards physical violence as a way to solve his marital conflicts, the marriage only lasted a few months, and thankfully, she made it out alive. While incarcerated for the crime of sexual assault against the woman from the psychiatric institution, Three things happened that expedited the killing spree of Gilbert Jordan that went on for the next decade. Firstly, and this one is my assumption, but it is the opinion of many, is that he realized there was no pleasure quite like the one he got from what happened to Ivy Rose Oswald. In each other incident where Gilbert Jordan preyed on a vulnerable victim for his own sexual gratification, whether it was indecent exposure or assault of a mentally distressed woman, they all fought back or had their wits about them a bit more than he would have liked. They could all, in one capacity or another, still reject him, whereas Ivy Rose, with a BAC of 0.51, simply could not. Secondly, Gilbert Jordan picked up a trade. He learned to be a barber, eventually turning into him strategically opening up a barbershop in Vancouver's downtown east side. Lastly, Gilbert Jordan either began investing and was wildly successful, or there was a significant inheritance awarded to him. Whatever the means of financial gain were, ultimately this recipe made Gilbert Jordan a wealthy, violent sexual deviant with bloodthirst for the vulnerable and all the means and resources in the world to position himself from Monday to Friday right within their epicenter. What we also know is that while incarcerated at the Haney Correctional Center in Maple Ridge, British Columbia, Gilbert Jordan underwent a court-mandated psychiatric assessment by Dr. Tibor Bezerity, who concluded that Gilbert Jordan had antisocial personality disorder, which, according to the current version of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, is characterized by social irresponsibility with exploitative, delinquent, and criminal behavior with no remorse. For some additional context about this diagnosis, there is conflicting literature about the intersection of antisocial personality disorder and psychopathy. However, many clinician scientists argue that there is significant overlap, with some positioning psychopathy as a subtype of antisocial personality disorder. Regardless of where Gilbert Jordan fell on the antisocial psychopathy spectrum, or if it's even a spectrum at all, what was abundantly clear to the psychiatrist assessing him was that Jordan was a person whose, quote, conduct is maladjusted in terms of social behaviors, end quote, and that he had a, quote, disregard for the rights of others, often resulting in unlawful activities, end quote. There was no doubt, according to this physician, that Gilbert Jordan was a threat to others, and yet at least six more women would die, most of whom were Indigenous, and they were all from Vancouver's downtown east side. Those who didn't die, and those whose family members were affected, as well as the community at large, were undoubtedly traumatized. Gilbert Jordan opened the Slocal Barbershop, and it was located at 2503 Kingsway, right across the street from a Church's Chicken, and just about 10 minutes away from the core of Vancouver's downtown east side. He liked to frequent the bars in that area, and as a meek-appearing, short, bald man, he seemed anything but dangerous against the backdrop of the downtown east side core, riddled with pawn shops, encampments, and all the signs of a struggling community. Of course, again, nobody knew about his criminal history or how dangerous he was, as he was able to dodge the dangerous violent sexual offender designation, and apparently, according to the court of law, most of his violent criminal history was not relevant to anything he was doing in the present. To the community, he was just old Gilbert, the barber who liked to drink, and was very generous with whom he bought drinks for, because of course, he had the financial means to be. He was also generous with how often he invited women back to various motel rooms he was renting. He was very comfortable in this area, with his barbershop only 10 minutes away, and any motel room he could ever want, within a short walking distance. He had everything he needed to become a violent serial killer. Just as he imagined. According to one article I read in the discontinued news outlet, The First Nations Drum, quote, it was easy for him to find the kind of woman that he felt were on their last legs. From what I understand about the downtown east side, this often tended to be disenfranchised Indigenous women, maybe those who didn't fit into the drug scene, but who appreciated a free drink and some good company. But let me be clear, good company he was not. Court documents show that Gilbert Jordan, during the time his barbershop was operational, sought out approximately 200 women per year for episodes of binge drinking, covering the period of 1980 to 1988. During these episodes, he would meet women in bars along East Hastings or elsewhere in the downtown East Side, invite them back to his barbershop or to a motel room he was renting, continue binge drinking with them, outpace them as someone consuming up to 50 ounces a day, and when the woman passed out or was on the brink of doing so, Gilbert Jordan would continue to pour alcohol down her throat until she was effectively incapacitated, or sometimes dead. As the first killer in Canadian history to use alcohol as a murder weapon, Gilbert Jordan would engage in his sick sexual fantasies with women who were resultingly left unable to reject him, before robbing them and leaving them for dead without a care in the world that his name was on the hotel room they would be found in, knowing full well that these women were considered to be less than by police and society at large. Some of these women include Mary Johnson, who died on November 30th, 1980, at the Almer Hotel with a blood alcohol content of 0.34. Her death was ruled accidental, and no charges were laid. Barbara Paul, who died on September 11th of 1981 at the Glenaird Hotel with a BAC of 0.41. Her death was ruled accidental, and no charges were laid. Mary Johns, who died on July 30th, 1982, inside of Gilbert Jordan's barbershop with a BAC of 0.76. Her death was ruled accidental, and no charges were laid. Patricia Thomas, who died on December 15th of 1984, also at his barbershop. Her death was ruled accidental, and no charges were laid. Patricia Andrew, who died on June 28th of 1985, also again at his barbershop, with a BAC of 0.79. Her death was ruled accidental, and no charges were laid. Throughout these deaths, Gilbert Jordan was still getting trouble for petty-er crimes relative to the sexual assault and murder of women, but he was trying to convince the courts that he wanted to turn his life around. He was blaming booze for his conduct, and he told the courts that he wanted to quit. I mention this, of course, because women were dying. They were being lured back to his quarters with alcohol that he was rapidly consuming and encouraging them to do the same, if not forcing them. And I mention this further because Vera Harry died on November 19th, 1986 at the Clifton Hotel with a BAC of 0.4. And again, her death was ruled accidental and no charges were laid. Although there was no real reason for the court system to believe Gilbert Jordan in his words, saying that he was going to quit drinking and that he wanted to turn his life around, especially given that women were dying all over Vancouver's downtown east side, they did anyways. On October 12th of 1987, Vanessa Lee Buckner was found naked and deceased on the floor of Gilbert's room at the Niagara Hotel after a night of binge drinking. She had an astonishing BAC of 0.91. There are conflicting reports about Vanessa. Her family and witnesses say that she wasn't a big drinker, and that her death made absolutely zero sense in the context of everything they knew about her. On the contrary, police say she was an alcoholic. But their interpretation of her lifestyle actually didn't matter this time, because regardless, this was the first death of its kind that police decided to fully investigate. Ironically, or maybe not so, Vanessa was the first white woman whose life was taken in this way. Police were tipped off about the death by an anonymous caller, which was actually Gilbert Jordan himself, who placed the call from a different hotel room at the Marble Arch Hotel and Strip Joint. However, although police had an autopsy report that noted her cause of death to be lethal amounts of alcohol supplied to her, and they also had someone who was tied to many similar deaths in the area over previous years making the phone call to report yet another death, police did not move fast enough to prevent another one. A month later, in 1987, Edna Shade was found dead in another hotel room. And although we don't know her BAC at the time of her death, it was concluded that she died of alcohol poisoning, and Gilbert Jordan's fingerprints were found on a bottle of vodka present at the scene. Still, he was not charged or questioned any further about the death of Edna Shade. However, the police did place him under surveillance. Between October 12th and November 26th of 1987, police in Vancouver watched as Gilbert Jordan sought out Indigenous women with the same modus operandi. Pick a target, buy her drinks, take her home, get her more drunk, have your way, and discard. According to police, on four separate occasions, they had to intervene and rescue the woman in Gilbert Jordan's clutches before she too became a deceased victim. These women were Rosemary Wilson, who was rescued on November 20th at the Balmoral Hotel. She was found with a BAC of 0.52. Verna Chartrant, who was rescued on November 21st, the very next day after Rosemary at the Pacific Hotel with a BAC of 0.43. Sheila Joe, who was rescued 4 days later on November 25th at the Rainbow Hotel, her BAC was unknown. And Mabel Wilson, who was rescued the very next day after that on November 26th, again at the Pacific Hotel, her BAC was also unknown. Police would report that during this surveillance period, they could hear Gilbert Jordan encouraging women to continue drinking well past their comfort level, persuading them with money and persistence. Quote, "Down the hatch, baby, you're a real woman. I'll give you $20 if you finish it." On and on and on. Gilbert Jordan got up in their faces, scared them, intimidated them, bribed them, and when they were too incapacitated to fight back, that's when he would strike. He would make these women drink until they couldn't anymore, let them black out or pass out, sexually assault them, and often continue pouring alcohol down their throats if he was unsatisfied with their level of incapacitation. Gilbert Jordan was tried in 1988 for one death and one death only, that of Vanessa Lee Buckner, in front of Judge Boak with no jury. At trial, he claimed that Vanessa was alive when he left the room in the morning to go get more alcohol, and when he returned, she was dead. He maintained that her drinking was not coerced and was entirely voluntary. However, evidence from her autopsy proved that she died of acute alcohol poisoning, resulting in aspiration of gastric contents into her airway and cessation of breathing. As a result, it's not very difficult to conclude that Vanessa would have very obviously been on the brink of death, if not already dead, well before Gilbert Jordan left the hotel room, and that she would have had to consume 30 ounces or almost an entire liter of liquor to get to that point, with a BAC of 0.91. Although it seemed obvious that Vanessa was either dying or dead at the time Gilbert Jordan left the room, and he knew that, they couldn't prove that he was complicit in the mechanism of her death. While the court could prove that he was negligent in it, they could not prove intent. Therefore, Justice Boak found him guilty of the charge of manslaughter for the death of Vanessa Buckner. On account of Gilbert Jordan being an obvious danger to society now, although this realization came much too late, Justice Boak attempted to make up for the charge with the sentence, sentencing Jordan to 15 years in prison, calling him a predator who used alcohol as his deadly instrument of choice. Unfortunately, as is again often the case for Gilbert Jordan, his 15-year sentence was reduced to 9 on appeal and reduced once again to 6 on a second appeal. When he was released in the 90s, he was placed on probation, which restricted him to the confines of Vancouver Island, and he was to avoid any licensed establishments in specified areas. He was also told he was not to be in the company of any woman where liquor was served, but of course, given his insatiable desires for control and predation, in 2000, he moved to the city of Victoria, and although he caught the attention of police immediately, he was able to still attempt more sex crimes. In June of 2000, he was charged with sexual assault, negligence causing bodily harm, and administering of a noxious substance, being alcohol. Frustratingly, although I'm unclear as to what the circumstances were, what I do know is that these charges were stayed once again, and that Gilbert Jordan walked free from them, despite everything. What I also know is that prior to these charges, he had made another attempt to change his name, this time to Paul Pierce. Prior to his application, the provincial government of British Columbia did not require fingerprints or a criminal background check to undertake a legal name change. However, once Gilbert Jordan filed the request, they closed this loophole very quickly. If the criminal justice system was going to allow him to walk amongst the public freely, it was certain at least they ought to know who he was. In November of 2000, a month after he walked free from the charges of sexual assault and administration of a noxious substance, amongst other things, he was arrested for a breach of probation after he met a young Indigenous woman at a bar, coerced her back to his hotel room, bribed her with alcohol, and physically blocked her exiting his room when she felt uncomfortable and wanted to leave. This incident escalated to the point where hotel staff had to intervene and rescue this woman. But ultimately, with or without pursuing any legal repercussions, everything about this scenario was a clear violation of his release conditions. So, all he was convicted for in 2001 was a probation violation. And this landed him back in jail for another 15-month stint before entering another 3-year probationary period. Without trying to sound like a broken record, promptly after he was released, he broke his probation conditions and was found in the presence of a woman while also in possession of alcohol. This landed him yet another 15-month stint and another 3-year probationary period, which he broke, unsurprisingly, and was arrested in 2004, this time in Winnipeg, in the province of Manitoba, after an incident much like the ones resulting in the deaths of 7 women had taken place. A woman had been found in severe medical condition in Gilbert Jordan's company at a hotel, in the presence of alcohol, and she had to be taken to hospital. She identified Gilbert Jordan being in her presence at the time that she got as sick as she did, which again landed him another jail sentence in another probationary period. When Gilbert Jordan returned back to Vancouver Island, despite his clear insistence on maintaining patterns of abuse against women involving alcohol and an affinity for the most vulnerable, the very most police could do was release a public statement warning of his return to the area. Quote, Jordan Gilbert Paul, age 73, is the subject of this alert. Police describe him as 5'9" and weighing 174 pounds. They say he is partially bald with gray hair and a gray goatee. They say he is currently in Victoria with no fixed address, meaning he was staying in motel rooms, as he always did. Police state that he has a significant criminal record including manslaughter and indecent assault of a female, and that he uses alcohol to lure his victims. They note what his court-ordered probation conditions are, including abstaining from alcohol and not to be in the company of women where alcohol is being served. But this is all that they could do. During the time he was active, Gilbert Jordan would eventually confess to having sex, although he doesn't differentiate how much of it was coerced or forced, with over 200 women. It's thought that hundreds of them had been subject to his tyranny, based on the number of women who he had targeted in just the short period of time he was being watched by police. I definitely believe it. Gilbert Jordan never accepted responsibility for his crimes. He blamed his criminal record on his alcohol addiction, and he claimed that he, quote, didn't give a damn who he was drinking with. And on this point, I actually believe him. In my own opinion, it's not that Gilbert Jordan was specifically targeting Indigenous women. It's that Indigenous women in British Columbia, on account of past and present colonial efforts, have been largely banished to the poorest postal code, the downtown east side, that exists in the richest city in this country. As a result, these women are targets for many types of predators on account of food, housing, and safety insecurity. Gilbert Jordan didn't care who he was drinking with, so long as the woman was lifeless enough not to resist his desires. He didn't care if she lived or died. If he did, I'm sure there would be many more victims. He also didn't care if she saw his face. He didn't care if she remembered. He didn't care if his name or his barber shop was tied to the room where she was found deceased in. He knew that these women were living under centuries of oppression and thus discarded by society and police. Therefore, he discarded them just the same. He knew that he could leverage his own alcohol addiction to fuel his desire for drunken sex and not even have to work very hard to have any of the deaths discounted on account of racialized stigma about Indigenous peoples and alcohol. Dr. Bizzardi was right about him. He had no regard for human life. But the Canadian government historically and presently positions Indigenous women to be amongst the most vulnerable members of our societies to predation on account of direct and indirect police violence as well, such as with legal apathy, which was so clearly demonstrated by the lenience of the criminal justice system towards Gilbert Jordan. Indigenous women were the target victim demographic of Gilbert Jordan, because the Canadian government, as well as the Canadian criminal justice system, and law enforcement agencies at every level of jurisdiction, put them there. Gilbert Jordan died in July of 2006, alone in a motel room from liver cirrhosis. He was a free man, and likely still dreaming of his next thrill until his very last breath. However, the death of Gilbert Jordan did not bring relief to the Indigenous women of Vancouver or the surrounding areas in British Columbia, nor did his consistent ability to get away with stuff breathe new life or motivation into law enforcement. The story of Gilbert Jordan and the lenience offered to him by the criminal justice system in Canada is a shining star example of how, when it comes to the safety of Indigenous women in this country, law enforcement is callous, and they are so unafraid of reprisal against blatant miscarriages of justice that they just continued to let it happen. And what happened next would exemplify the consequences of that. The death of Gilbert Jordan came shortly after Robert Picton began his tirade of murders against Indigenous women in the same area. Robert Picton's arrest is timely with the onset of killings of Indigenous women by Cody Legebokoff, who was killing women between 2009 and 2010. Indigenous women have been going missing and turning up dead in British Columbia and across the country at a disproportionate rate still. There was the Alley murders, the Northern BC murders, the Highway of Tears, whom Cody Legebokoff is only partially responsible for, alongside Edward Dennis Isaac, and who knows who else. Across the country, Indigenous women are being targeted in Manitoba by Jeremy Skibicki, among others, John Crawford in Saskatchewan, and potentially countless others whose crimes may never be uncovered due to ongoing apathy from law enforcement about the lives of Indigenous women, girls, and 2S-identifying Indigenous peoples. And if something doesn't change, and we don't start talking about this openly, and we don't say something when we see something, and we don't take action to ensure that the most vulnerable in our communities are taken care of, as is the government's responsibility, then nothing will change. In 2017, during the first public hearings of the inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, which took place in Whitehorse in Yukon Territory, family members of Mary Johns, who was murdered by Gilbert Jordan, spoke about how her family searched on foot for Mary in light of police effort to investigate her disappearance. They spoke about how, even after her death was discovered, their family was left scrambling for hope when the answers were so blatant. They didn't understand why there was no action. In my opinion, Mary's sister-in-law, Frances Newman, who spoke during these hearings, eloquently encapsulates exactly how I want to end this series. She says, quote, "We must stand up for the justice for these women that have walked before us, to give voice that was taken away so unjustly." My apologies for delays in finishing this series and getting episodes published to you all. I am thrilled to have completed the series while covering as many different topics surrounding the MMIWG 2S Plus crisis in Canada, and I hope that you feel inspired to continue learning about past and present colonial injustices, and feel compelled in our collective duty to give voices to those taken so unjustly. I hope you feel compelled to do right by the women who were the original caretakers of the lands we settled on, who are the rightful descendants, and for them to have a better chance at living the free, self-governed lives that they were meant to be protected by the systems that they were forced to be placed within. It's the very least that we can do. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Crimopedia podcast. For all source material I use for today's episode, you can find it on my website at crimopediapod.ca. If you want to connect to suggest a case or just talk about one that I've already discussed, you can also do that on my website, or you can find me on Instagram at crimopediapod. Thank you, everyone. Stay well, stay safe, and free Palestine.